status made a relationship between us inadvisable from my point of view, but I still eyed him with interest. He was what they call Black Irish, dark-haired, blue-eyed, with perhaps a streak of masochism. I didn't know him well enough to determine how much of his suffering was of his own devising, and I wasn't sure I wanted to find out. Sometimes I think an unconsummated affair is the wisest course in any event. No hassles, no demands, no disappointments, and both partners keep all their neuroses under wraps. Whatever the surface appearances, most human beings come equipped with convoluted emotional machinery. With intimacy, the wreckage starts to show, damage rendered in the course of passions colliding like freight trains on the same track. I'd had enough of that over the years. I wasn't in any better shape than he was, so why complicate life? Two rings and the call was picked up.
Missing persons. Sergeant Robb.
Hello, Jonah. It's Kinsey.
Hey, babe, he said. What can I do for you that's legal in this state?
I smiled. How about a field check on a couple of ex-cons?
Sure, no sweat, he said.
I gave him both names and what little information I had. He took it down and said he'd get back to me. He'd fill out a form and have the inquiry run through the National Crime Information Computer, a federal offense since I'm really not entitled to access. Generally, a private investigator has no more rights than the average citizen, and relies on ingenuity, patience, and resourcefulness for facts that law enforcement agencies have available as a matter of course. It's a frustrating but not impossible state of affairs. I simply cultivate relationships with people plugged into the system at various points. I have contacts at the telephone company, the credit bureau, Southern California Gas, Southern Cal Edison, and the DMV. Occasionally, I can make a raid on certain government offices, but only if I have something worthwhile to trade. As for information of a more personal sort, I can usually depend on people's tendencies to rat on one another at the drop of a hat. I made up a check sheet for Billy Polo and went to work. Knowing Jonah, he'd call probation and pick up Polo's current address. In the meantime, I wanted to tag some bases of my own. A personal search always pays unexpected dividends. I didn't want to bypass the possibility of surprise, as that's half the fun. I knew Polo wasn't listed in the current phone book, but I tried information, thinking he might have had a phone put in. There was no new listing for him. I put a call through to my pal at the utility company, inquiring about a possible service connection. Their records showed nothing. Apparently, he hadn't applied for water, gas, or electricity in the area in his own name, but he could be renting a room somewhere, paying a flat rate with utilities thrown in. I put calls through to 5 or 6 flea-bag hotels on Lower State Street. Polo wasn't registered, and nobody seemed to spark to the name. While I was at it, I tried John Daggett's name and got nowhere. I knew I wouldn't get so much as a by-your-leave from the local Social Security office, and I doubted I'd find Billy Polo's name among the voter registration files. Which left what? I checked my watch. Only 30 minutes had passed since I talked to Jonah. I wasn't sure how long it would take him to call back, and I didn't want to waste time sitting around until I heard from him. I grabbed my windbreaker, locked the office, and went down the front stairs to State Street, walking 2 blocks over and 2 blocks up to the public library. I found an empty table in the reference department and hauled out Santa Teresa telephone directories for the past 5 years, checking back year by year. 4 books back, I found Polo. Great! I made a note of the Merced Street address, wondering if his prison sentence accounted for the absence of a listing since then. I went over to the section on Santa Teresa history and pulled out the city directory for that year. In addition to an alphabetical listing by name, the city directory lists addresses alphabetically, so that if you have an address and want to know the resident, you can thumb to the street and number and pick up the name of the occupant and a telephone number. In the back half, telephone numbers are listed sequentially. If all you have is a telephone number, the city directory will provide you with a name and address. By cross-referencing the address, you can come up with the name again, an occupation, and the names of neighbors all up and down the same street. In 10 minutes, I had a list of 7 people who had lived in range of Billy Polo on Merced. By checking for those 7 in the current directory, I determined that 2 were still living there. I jotted down both current telephone numbers, returned the books to their proper places, and headed back toward my office. The sunlight, intermittent for the last hour, was now largely blocked by incoming clouds, which had crowded out blue sky, leaving only an occasional patch, like a hole in a blanket. The air was beginning to cool rapidly, a damp breeze worrying at women's hems. I looked toward the ocean and spotted that silent veil of gray that betokens rain already falling some miles out. I quickened my pace. Once in my office again, I entered the new information in the file I'd opened. I was just on the verge of closing up for the day when I heard a tap at the door. I hesitated, then crossed to the door and peered out. There was a woman standing in the corridor, late 30s, expressionless and pale. "Can I help you?" I said. "I'm Barbara Daggett." Quickly, I prayed this wasn't wife number 3. I tried the optimistic approach. "John Daggett's daughter?"
"Yes."
She was one of those icy blondes, with skin as finely textured as a percale bedsheet, tall, substantially built, with short, coarse hair fanning straight back from her face. She had high cheekbones, a delicate brow, and her father's piercing gaze. Her right eye was green, her left eye blue. I'd seen a white cat like that once, and it had had the same disconcerting effect. She was wearing a gray wool business suit and a prim, high-necked white blouse with a froth of lace at the throat. Her heels were a burgundy leather and matched her shoulder bag. She looked like an attorney or a stockbroker, someone accustomed to power. "Come on in," I said. "I was just trying to figure out how to get in touch with him. I take it your mother told you I stopped by." I was making small talk. She wasn't having any of it. She sat down, turning those riveting eyes on me as I moved around to my side of the desk and took a seat. I thought of offering her coffee, but I really didn't want her to stay that long. Even the air around her seemed chilly, and I didn't like the way she looked at me. I rocked back in my swivel chair. "What can I do for you?"
"I want to know why you're looking for my father."
I shrugged, underplaying it, sticking to the story I'd started with. "I'm not really. I'm looking for a friend of his."
"Why weren't we told Daddy was out of prison? My mother's in a state of collapse. We had to call the doctor and have her sedated."
"I'm sorry to hear that," I said. Barbara Daggett crossed her legs and smoothed her skirt, her movements agitated.
"Sorry. You don't know what this has done to her. She was just beginning to feel safe. Now we find out he's in town somewhere, and she's very upset. I don't understand what's going on."
"Miss Daggett, I'm not a parole officer," I said. "I don't know when he got out or why nobody notified you. Your mother's problems didn't start yesterday." A bit of color came to her cheeks.
"That's true. Her problems started the day she married him. He's ruined her life. He's ruined life for all of us."
"Are you referring to his drinking?" She brushed right over that.
"I want to know where he's staying. I have to talk to him."
"At the moment, I have no idea where he is. If I find him, I'll tell him you're interested. That's the best I can do."
"My uncle tells me you saw him on Saturday."
"Only briefly."
"What was he doing in town?"
"We didn't discuss that," I said.
"But what did you talk about?"
"What possible business could he have had with a private detective?" I had no intention of giving her information, so I tried her technique and ignored the question. I pulled a legal pad over and picked up a pen. "Is there a number where you can be reached?" She opened her handbag and took out a business card, which she passed across the desk to me. Her office address was 3 blocks away on State, and her title indicated that she was chairman and chief executive officer of a company called FMS. As if in response to a question, she said, "I develop financial management software systems for manufacturing firms. That's my office number. I'm not listed in the book. If you need to reach me at home, this is the number."
"Sounds interesting," I remarked. "What's your background?"
"I have a math and chemistry degree from Stanford and a double master's in computer sciences and engineering from USC.
I felt my brows lift appreciatively. I couldn't see any evidence that Daggett had ruined her life, but I kept the observation to myself. There was clearly more to Barbara Daggett than her professional status indicated. Maybe she was one of those women who succeeds in business and fails in relationships with men. As I'd been accused of that myself, I decided not to make a judgment. Where is it written that being part of a couple is a measure of anything? She glanced at her watch and stood up.
"I have an appointment. Please let me know if you hear from him."
"May I ask what you want with him?"
"I've been urging Mother to file for divorce, but so far she's refused. Maybe I can persuade him instead."
I'm surprised she didn't divorce him years ago.
Her smile was cold. She says she married him for better or for worse. To date, there hasn't been any better. Maybe she's hoping for a taste of that before she gives up.
What about his imprisonment? What was that for?
Something flickered in her face, and I thought at first she wouldn't answer me.
Vehicular manslaughter, she said finally. He was drunk and there was an accident. 5 people were killed, 2 of them kids.
I couldn't think of a response, and she didn't seem to expect one. She stood up, closed the conversation with a perfunctory handshake, and then she was gone. I could hear her high heels tapping away down the corridor.
Chapter 5. By the time I closed up the office and got down to my car, the clouds overhead looked like dark gray vacuum cleaner fluff, and the rain had begun to splatter the sidewalk with polka dots. I stuck Daggett's file on the passenger seat and backed out of my space, turning right from the parking lot onto Cannon and right again onto Chapel. 3 blocks up, I made a stop, ducking into the supermarket to pick up milk, Diet Pepsi, bread, eggs, and toilet paper. I was into my siege mentality, looking forward to pulling up the drawbridge and waiting out the rain. With luck, I wouldn't have to go out for days. The phone was ringing as I let myself in. I put the grocery bag on the counter and snatched up the receiver.
God, I was just about to give up, Jonah said. I tried the office, but all I got was your answering machine.
I closed up for the day. I can work at home if I'm in the mood, which I'm not. Have you seen the rain?
Rain?
Oh, yeah, so there is. I haven't even looked out the window since I got in.
God, that's great, he said. Listen, I have some of the information you're looking for, and the rest will have to wait. Woody's got a priority request, and I had to back off. I'm working tomorrow, so I can pick it up then.
You're working Saturday?
I'm filling in for Sobel. My good deed for the week, he said. Got a pencil? Polo's the one I got a line on.
He rattled out Billy Polo's age, date of birth, height, weight, hair, and eye color, his AKA, and a hasty rundown of his record, all of which I noted automatically. He'd picked up the name of Billy's parole officer, but the guy was out of the office and wouldn't be available until Monday afternoon.
Thanks. In the meantime, I'm nosing around on my own, I said. I bet I'll get a line on him before you do.
He laughed and hung up. I put groceries away and then sat down at my desk, hauling out the little portable Smith Corona I keep in the knee hole. I consigned the data Joan had given me to index cards and then sat and stared at it. Billy Polo, born William Polakowski, was 30 years old, 5'8", 160 pounds, brown hair, brown eyes, no scars, tattoos, or observable physical oddities. His rap sheet sounded like a pop quiz on the California Penal Code, with arrests that ranged from misdemeanors to felonies. Assault, forgery, receiving stolen property, grand theft, narcotics violations. Once he was even convicted of injuring a public jail, a misdemeanor in this state. Had this occurred in the course of an escape attempt, the charge would have been bumped up to a felony. As it was, he'd probably been caught scratching naughty words on the jailhouse walls. A real champ, this one. Apparently, Billy Polo was pretty shiftless when it came to breaking the law, and had never even settled on an area of expertise. He'd been arrested 16 times with 9 convictions, 2 acquittals, 5 dismissals. Twice he'd been put on probation, but nothing seemed to have affected the nature of his behavior, which appeared nearly pathological in its thrust. The man was determined to screw up. Since the age of 18, he'd spent an accumulated 9 years in jail. No telling what his juvenile record looked like. I assumed his acquaintance with John Daggett dated from his latest offense, an armed robbery conviction for which he'd served 2 years and 10 months at the California Men's Colony at San Luis Obispo, a medium security facility about 90 miles north of Santa Teresa. I pulled out the telephone book again and checked for a listing under the name Polakowski. Nothing. God, why can't anything be simple in this business? Oh, well, I wasn't going to worry about it for the moment. By now I could hear the rain tapping on the glass-enclosed breezeway that connects my place to Henry Pitt's house. He's my landlord, and has been for nearly 2 years. In dry weather, he places an old shaker cradle out there filled with rising bread. When the sun is out, the space is like a solar oven, warm and sheltered, dough puffing up over the rim of the cradle like a feather pillow. He can proof 20 loaves at a time, then bake them in the big industrial-sized oven he had installed when he retired from commercial baking. Now he trades fresh bread and pastries for services in the neighborhood, and stretches his Social Security payments by clipping coupons avidly. He picks up additional income constructing crossword puzzles, which he sells to a couple of those pint-sized magazines you can purchase in a supermarket checkout line. Henry Pitts is 81 years old, and everyone knows I'm half in love with him. I considered popping over to see him, but even the 50-foot walk seemed like too much to deal with in the wet. I put some tea water on and picked up my book, stretching out on the sofa with a quilt pulled over me. And that's how I spent the rest of the day. During the night, the rain escalated, and I woke up twice to hear it lashing at the windows. It sounded like somebody spraying the side of the place with a hose. At intervals, thunder rumbled in the distance, and my windows flickered with blue light. Tree branches illuminated briefly before the room went black again. It was clear I'd have to cancel my 6 a.m. run, an obligatory day off. So I burrowed into the depths of my quilt like a little animal, delighted at the idea of sleeping late.
End of Disc 1. Disc 2.
It was clear I'd have to cancel my 6 a.m. run, an obligatory day off. So I burrowed into the depths of my quilt like a little animal, delighted at the idea of sleeping late. I woke at 8 o'clock, showered, dressed, and fixed myself a soft-boiled egg on toast with lots of Lowry's seasoned salt. I'm not going to give up salt. I don't care what they say. Jonah called as I was washing my plate. He said, "Hey, guess what? Your friend Daggett showed." I tucked the receiver into the crook of my neck, turning off the water and drying my hands. What happened? Did he get picked up?
More or less. A scruffy drifter spotted him face down in the surf this morning, tangled up in a fishing net. A skiff washed ashore about 200 yards away. We're pretty sure it connects.
He died last night?
Looks like it. The coroner estimates he went into the water sometime between midnight and 5 a.m. We don't have a determination yet on the cause and manner of death. We'll know more after the autopsy's done, of course.
How'd you find out it was him?
Fingerprints. He was over at the morgue listed as a John Doe until we ran the computer check. You want to take a look?
I'll be right there.
What about next of kin? Have they been notified? Yeah, the beat officer went over as soon as we made the ID. You know the family?
Not well, but we've met. I wouldn't want to be quoted on this, but I think you'll find out he's a bigamist. There's a woman down in L.A. who also claims she's married to him.
Cute. You better come talk to us when you leave St. Terry's, he said, and hung up. The Santa Teresa Police Department doesn't really have a morgue of its own. There's a coroner sheriff, an elected office in this county, but the actual forensic work is contracted out among various pathologists in the Tri-County area. The morgue space itself is divided between Santa Teresa Hospital, commonly referred to as St. Terry's, and the former County General Hospital facility on the frontage road off 101. Daggett was apparently at St. Terry's, which was where I headed as soon as I'd rounded up my slicker and umbrella and my handbag. The visitor's lot at the hospital was half empty. It was Saturday, and doctors would probably be making rounds later in the day. The sky was thick with clouds, and high up I could see the wind whipping through like a fan, blowing white mist across the gray. The pavement was littered with small branches, leaves plastered flat against the ground. Puddles had formed everywhere, pockmarked by the steady rainfall. I parked as close to the rear entrance as I could, and then locked my car and made a dash for it.
Kinsey!
I turned as I reached the shelter of the building. Barbara Daggett hurried toward me from the far side of the lot, her umbrella tilted against the slant of the rain. She was wearing a raincoat and spike-heeled boots, her white blonde hair forming a halo around her face. I held the door open for her, and we ducked into the foyer.
You heard about my father?
That's why I'm here. Do you know how it happened?
Not really. Uncle Eugene called me at 8:15. I guess they tried to notify Mother, and he interceded. The doctor has her so doped up it doesn't make any sense to tell her yet. He's worried about how she'll take it, as unstable as she is.
Is your uncle coming down?
She shook her head.
I said I'd do it. There's no doubt it's Daddy, but somebody has to sign for the body so the mortuary can come pick it up. Of course they'll autopsy first.
How did you find out?
Through a cop I know. I told him I was trying to get a line on your father, so he called me when they got a match on the fingerprints.
Did you manage to locate him yesterday?
No, but it's clear someone did.
She closed her umbrella and gave it a shake, then glanced at me.
Frankly, I'm assuming somebody killed him.
Let's not be too quick off the mark, I said, though privately I agreed. The two of us moved through the inner door and into the corridor. The air was warmer here and smelled of latex paint.
I want you to look into it for me in any event, she said.
Hey, listen, that's what the police are for. I don't have the scope for that.
Why don't you wait and see what they have to say first?
She studied me briefly and then moved on.
They don't give a damn what happened to him. Why would they care? He was a drunken bum.
Oh, come on. Cops don't have to care, I said. If it's homicide, they have a job to do, and they'll do it well.
When we reached the autopsy room, I knocked, and a young black morgue attendant came out, dressed in surgical greens. His name tag indicated that his name was Hall Ingram. He was lean, his skin the color of pecan wood, with a high-gloss finish. His hair was cropped close and gave him the look of a piece of sculpture, his elongated face nearly stylized in its perfection.
"This is Barbara Daggett," I said.
He looked in her direction without meeting her eyes.
"You can wait right down here," he said.
He moved two doors down, and we followed, pausing politely while he unlocked a viewing room and ushered us in.
"It'll be just a minute," he said.
He disappeared, and we took a seat. The room was small, maybe 9 by 9, with four blue molded plastic chairs hooked together at the base, a low wooden table covered with old magazines, and a television screen affixed, at an angle, up in one corner of the room. I saw her gaze flick to it.
"Closed circuit," I said. "They'll show him up there."
She picked up a magazine and began to flip through it distractedly.
"You never really told me why he hired you," she said.
An ad for pantyhose had apparently caught her eye, and she studied it as if my reply were of no particular concern. I couldn't think of a reason not to tell her at this point, but I noticed that I censored myself to some extent, a habit of long-standing. I like to hold something back. Once information is out, it can't be recalled, so it's better to exercise caution before you flap your mouth.
"He wanted me to find a kid named Tony Gahan," I said.
That remarkable two-toned gaze came up to meet mine, and I found myself trying to decide which eye color I preferred. The green was more unusual, but the blue was clear and stark. The two together presented a contradiction, like the signal at a street corner, flashing walk and don't walk simultaneously.
"You know him?" I asked.
"His parents and a younger sister were the ones killed in the accident, along with two other people in the car with them."
"What did Daddy want with him?"
"He said Tony Gahan helped him once when he was on the run from the cops. He wanted to thank him."
Her look was incredulous.
"But that's bullshit."
"So I gather," I said.
She might have pressed for more information, but the television screen flashed with snow at that moment, and then flipped over to a close-up of John Daggett. He was lying on a gurney, a sheet neatly pulled up to his neck. He had the blank, plastic look that death sometimes brings, as if the human face were no more than an empty page, on which the lines of emotion and experience are transcribed and then erased. He looked closer to 20 years old than 55, with a stubble of beard and hair carelessly arranged. His face was unmarked. Barbara stared at him, her lips parting, her face diffused with pink. Tears rose in her eyes and hung there, captured in the well of her lower lids. I looked away from her, unwilling to intrude any more than I had to. The morgue attendant's voice reached us through the intercom.
"Let me know when you're done."
Barbara turned away abruptly.
"Thank you. That's fine," I called. The television screen went dark.
Moments later there was a tap at the door, and he reappeared with a sealed manila envelope and a clipboard in hand.
"We'll need to know what arrangements you want made," he said.
He was using that tone of studied neutrality I've heard before from those who deal with the bereaved. Its effect is impersonal and soothing, liberating one to transact business without intrusive emotionalism. He needn't have bothered,
Barbara Daggett was a businesswoman, bred to that awesome poise that so unsettles men accustomed to female subservience. Her manner now was smooth and detached, her tone as impassive as his. "I've talked to Winnington Blake," she said, indicating one of the funeral homes in town. "If you'll notify them once the autopsy's done, they'll take care of everything. Is that form for me?" He nodded and held the clipboard out to her with a pen attached.
"A release for his personal effects," he said.
She dashed off a signature as if she were signing an autograph for a pesky fan.
"When will you have the autopsy results?"
He handed her the envelope, which apparently contained Daggett's odds and ends.
"Probably by late afternoon."
"Who's doing the post?" I asked.
"Dr. Yi. He's scheduled it for 2:30.
Barbara Daggett glanced at me. "She's a private investigator. I want all information released to her." "Will I need to sign a separate authorization for that?"
"I don't know. There's probably some procedure, but it's a new one on me. I can check into it and contact you later if you like."
She slipped her business card under the clamp as she handed the clipboard back to him. "Do that." His eyes met hers for the first time, and I could see him register the oddity of the mismatched irises. She brushed past him, moving out of the room. He stared after her. The door closed. I held my hand out. "I'm Kinsey Milhone, Mr. Ingram." He smiled for the first time.
"Oh, yeah. I heard about you from Kelly Borden. Nice to meet you."
Kelly Borden was a morgue attendant I'd met during a homicide investigation I'd worked on in August. "Nice to meet you, too," I said. "What's the story on this one?"
"I can't tell you much. They brought him in about 7, just as I was coming to work."
"Do you have any idea how long he'd been dead?"
"I don't know for sure, but it couldn't have been long. The body wasn't bloated, and there wasn't any putrefaction. From what I've seen of drowning victims, I'd guess he went in the water late last night. Don't quote me on that. The watch he had on was stopped at 2:37, but it could have been broken. It's a crummy watch and looks all beat up. It's in with his effects. Hell, what do I know? I'm just a flunky, lowest of the low.
Dr. Yi hates it if we talk to people like this." "Believe me, I'm not going to say anything. I'm just asking for my own purposes. What about his clothing? How was he dressed?"
"Jacket, pants, shirt."
"Shoes and socks?"
"Well, shoes. He didn't have socks on, and he didn't have a wallet or anything like that."
"Any signs of injury?"
"None that I've seen."
I couldn't think of anything else I wanted to ask for the moment, so I thanked him and said I'd be in touch. Then I went out to look for Barbara Daggett. If I was going to work for her, we needed to get business squared away. Chapter 6. I found her standing in the foyer, looking out at the parking lot. The rain was falling monotonously, occasional gusts of wind tossing the treetops. Cozy-looking lights were on in all the buildings that rimmed the parking lot, which only emphasized the dampness and the chill outside. A nurse, her white uniform flashing from the flaps of a dark blue raincoat, approached the doorway, leaping over puddles like a kid playing hopscotch. Her white hose were speckled with flesh-colored blotches where the rain had soaked through, and the tops of her white shoes were spattered with mud. She reached the entrance, and I held the door for her. She flashed me a smile.
"Whew! Thanks. It's like an obstacle course out there."
She shook the water from her raincoat and padded down the hallway, crepe soles leaving a pattern of damp footprints in her wake. Barbara Daggett seemed rooted to the spot.
"I have to go to Mother's," she said. "Somebody has to tell her."
She turned and looked at me.
"How much do you charge for your services?"
"$30 an hour plus expenses, which is standard for the area. If you're serious, I can drop a contract off at your office this afternoon."
"What about a retainer?"
I made a quick assessment. I usually ask for an advance, especially in a situation like this, when I know I'll be talking to the cops. There's no concept of privilege between a PI and a client, but at least the front money makes it clear where my loyalties lie.
$400 should cover it," I said.
I wondered if the figure came to mind because of Daggett's bounced check. Oddly enough, I felt protective of him. He'd conned me, there was no doubt of that. But I had agreed to work for him, and in my mind I still had a duty to discharge. Of course, I might not have felt as charitable if he were still alive, but the dead are defenseless,
And somebody in this world has to look out for them.
I'll have my secretary cut you a check first thing Monday morning, she said.
She turned back, looking out the double doors into the gloom. She leaned her head against the glass.
Are you okay?
You don't know how many times I've wished him dead, she said. Have you ever dealt with an alcoholic?
I shook my head.
They're so maddening. I used to look at him, and I was convinced he could quit drinking if he wanted to. I don't know how many times I talked to him, begging him to stop. I thought he didn't understand. I thought he just wasn't aware of what we were going through, my mother and me. I can remember the look he'd get in his eyes when he was drunk. Little pink piggy eyes. His whole body radiated this odor. Bourbon. God, I hate that stuff. He smelled like somebody dropped a bottle of early times down a heater vent. Waves of smell. He reeked of it.
She looked over at me, her eyes dry and pitiless. I'm 34, and I've hated him with every cell in my body for as long as I can remember. And now I'm stuck with it. He won, didn't he? He never changed, never straightened up, never gave us an inch. He was such a shitheel. It makes me want to smash this glass door out. I don't even know why I care how he died. I should be relieved, but I'm pissed. The irony is that he's probably still going to dominate my life.
How so?
Look what he's done to me already. I think of him every time I have a drink. I think of him if I decide not to have a drink. If I even meet a man who drinks, or if I see a bum on the street or smell bourbon, his face is the first thing that comes to mind. Oh, God. And if I'm around someone who's had too much, I can't stand it. I disconnect. My life is filled with reminders of him. His apologies, and his phony, wheedling charm, his boo-hooing when the booze got to him. The times he fell, the times he got put in jail, the times he spent every dime we had. When I was 12, Mother got religion, and I don't know which was worse. At least Daddy woke up most days in okay shape. She had Jesus for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It was grotesque. And then there were the joys of being an only child.
She broke off abruptly and seemed to shake herself.
Oh, hell, what difference does it make? I know I sound sorry for myself, but it's been such a bitch and there's no end in sight.
Actually, you look like you've done pretty well, I said.
She turned her gaze back to the parking lot, and I could see her faint, bitter smile reflected in the glass.
You know what they say about living well is the best revenge? I did well because it was the one defense I had. Escape has been the motivating force in my life. Getting away from him, getting away from her, putting that household behind me. The funny thing is, I haven't moved an inch, and the harder I run, the faster I keep slipping back to them. There are spiders that work like that. They bury themselves and create a little pocket of loose dirt. Then when their prey comes along, the soil gives way, and the victim slides right down into the trap. There are laws for everything except the harm families do.
She turned, shoving her hands down in her raincoat pockets. She pushed the door open with her backside, and a draft of cold air rushed in.
What about you? Are you leaving, or will you stick around?
I guess I'll hit the office as long as I'm out, I said. She pressed a button on the handle of her umbrella, and it lifted into the open position with a muffled thunk. She held it for me, and we walked toward my car together. The raindrops tapping on the umbrella fabric made a muted sound, like popcorn in a covered saucepan. I unlocked my car and got in while she moved off toward hers, calling back over her shoulder.
Try me at the office as soon as you hear anything. I should be there by 2.
My office building was deserted. California Fidelity is closed on weekends, so their offices were dark. I let myself in, picking up the batch of morning mail that had been shoved through the slot. There were no messages on my answering machine. I pulled a contract out of my top drawer and spent a few minutes filling in the blanks. I checked Barbara Daggett's business card to verify the address. Then I locked up again and went down the front stairs. I walked the 3 blocks and dropped the contract off at her office, then headed over to the police station on Floresta. The combination of the weekend and the bad weather lent the station much the same deserted air as my office building. Crime doesn't adhere to a 40-hour week, but there are days when even the criminals don't seem to feel like doing much. The linoleum showed a gridwork of wet footprints, like a pattern of dance steps too complex to learn. The air smelled of cigarette smoke and damp uniforms. I could see where someone had fashioned a folded newspaper into a rain hat, and then abandoned it on the wooden bench just inside the door.
One of the clerks in the identification and record section buzzed Jonah, and he came out to the locked foyer door and admitted me. He wasn't looking good. During the summer, he'd shed an excess 20 pounds, and he'd told me he was still working out at the gym, so it wasn't that. His dark hair seemed poorly trimmed, and the lines around his eyes were pronounced. He also had that weary aura that unhappiness seems to breed. "What happened to you?" I asked as we walked back to his office. He'd been reconciled with his wife since June, after a year's separation, and from what I'd gathered, it was not going well.
"She wants an open relationship," he remarked.
"Oh, come on," I said with disbelief. That netted me a tired smile.
"That's what the lady says."
He held the door open for me, and we passed into an L-shaped room furnished with big wooden desks. Missing persons is included in crimes against persons, which in turn is considered part of the investigations division, along with crimes against property, narcotics, and special investigations. The room was deserted at the moment, but people came and went at intervals. From the interview room off the inside corridor, I could hear the rise and fall of a shrill female voice, and I guessed that an interrogation was underway. Jonah closed the hall door, automatically protective of department business. He filled two styrofoam cups with coffee and brought them over, handing me packets of Cremora and Equal. Just what I needed, a cup of hot chemicals. We went through the motions of doctoring the coffee, which smelled like it had been on the burner too long. I took a few minutes to lay out the Daggett situation. At this point, we didn't have the results of the autopsy, so the idea of murder was purely theoretical. Still, I told Jonah what had gone on to date, detailing the principal characters. I was talking to him as a friend instead of a cop, and he listened as an interested but unofficial party.
"So, how long was he up here before he died?" Jonah asked.
"Since Monday, presumably," I said. "It's possible he went somewhere else first, but Lavella seemed to think he'd head straight for Billy Polo if he needed help."
"Did that information on Polo do you any good?"
"Not yet, but it will. I'm just waiting to see what we've got on our hands before I proceed. Even if the death was accidental, I suspect Barbara Daggett will want me to look into it. I mean, for starters, what was he doing on a boat in a rainstorm? And where has he been all this time?"
"Where have you been?" Jonah asked.
I focused on him and realized he'd shifted the subject.
"Who, me? I've been around."
He picked up a pencil and began to tap out a beat, like a man auditioning for a tiny blues band. "He was giving me a look I'd seen before, full of heat and speculation."
"Are you dating anyone?"
I shook my head, smiling slightly. "The only good men I know are married." I was being flirtatious, and he seemed to like that. His blue eyes locked into mine, and the color rose in his face.
"What do you do for sex?"
"Jog on the beach. How about you?" He smiled, breaking off eye contact.
"In other words, it's none of my business."
I laughed. "I'm not avoiding the question. I'm telling the truth."
"Really?
That's funny. I always pictured you out raising hell." "I did some of that years ago, but I can't stand it these days. Sex is a bonding process. I'm careful who I connect up with. Besides, you don't know what the marketplace is like. A one-night stand is more like a wrestling match with a couple of quick takedowns. Talk about demoralizing. I'd rather be alone."
"I know what you mean. I was out there hustling some the year she was gone, but I never got the hang of it. I'd go in a bar and some babe would sidle up to me, but I never made the right moves. Couple of times women told me I was rude when I just thought I was making small talk."
"It's worse if you're successful at it," I said. "Be grateful you never learned the gamesmanship. I know a couple of guys on the circuit, and they're hard as nails, you know? Unhappy. Hostile toward women. They get laid, but that's about all they get." Behind him, Lieutenant Becker came in and took a seat at a desk across the room. Jonah's pencil tapping started again and then stopped. He tossed it aside and rocked back in his chair.
"I wish life were simple," he said.
I kept my tone of voice mild.
"Life is simple. You're the one making things complex.
You were doing great without Camilla, as far as I could see. She crooks her finger, though, and you go running back. And now you can't figure out what went wrong. Quit acting like a victim when you did it to yourself."
This time he laughed. "God, Kinsey, why don't you just say what's on your mind?"
Well, I don't understand voluntary suffering. If you're unhappy, change something. If you can't make it work, then bail out. What's the big deal?
Is that what you did?
Not quite. I dumped the first and the second one dumped me. With both, I did my share of suffering, but when I look back on it, I can't understand why I endured so long. It was dumb. It was a big waste of time and cost me a lot.
I've never even heard you mention those guys.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you about them sometime.
You want to have a drink when I get off work?
I looked at him briefly and then shook my head.
We'd end up in bed, Jonah.
That's the point, isn't it? He smiled and did a Groucho Marx wiggle with his eyebrows. I laughed and turned the subject back to Daggett as I got up. Call me when Dr. Yee has results on the post.
I'll call for more than that.
Get your life squared away first. When I left, he was still staring after me, and it was all I could do to get out of there. I had this troubling urge to gallop over and leap onto his lap, laughing while I covered his face with licks. But I didn't think the department would ever be the same. As I glanced back, I could see Becker giving us a speculative look while he pretended to check his inbox. Chapter 7 Daggett's death was ruled accidental. Jonah called me at home at 4 o'clock to give me the news. I'd spent the afternoon again wrapped up in a quilt, hoping to finish the book. I'd just put on a fresh pot of coffee, and I was scurrying back under the covers as the phone rang. When he told me, I was puzzled, but I wasn't convinced. I kept waiting for the punchline, but there wasn't one. "I don't get it," I said. "Does Yee know the background on this?"
"Babe, Daggett's blood alcohol was 0.35. You're talking acute ethanol intoxication, almost coma stage."
"And that was the cause of death?"
"Well, no, he drowned, but Yee says there's no evidence of foul play. None. Daggett went out in a boat, got tangled up in a fishing net, and fell overboard, too drunk to save himself."
"Bullshit."
"Kinsey, some people die accidentally. It's a fact."
"I don't believe it. Not this one."
"The crime scene investigation unit didn't find a thing. Not even a hint. What can I say? You know these guys. They're as good as they come. If you think it's murder, come up with some evidence. In the meantime, we're calling it an accident. As far as we're concerned, the case is closed."
"What was he doing dead drunk in a boat?" I asked. "The man was broke and it was raining cats and dogs. Who'd he rent the boat from?"
I could hear Jonah sigh. "He didn't. Apparently he took a little 10-foot skiff from its mooring off the dock at Marina One. The harbor master identified the boat, and you can see where the line was cut."
"Where'd they find it?"
"On the beach near the pier. There weren't any usable prints."
"I don't like it."
"Look, I know what you're saying, and you've got a point. I tend to agree, if that makes you feel any better, but who's asking us? Look at it as a gift. If the death is ruled a homicide, you can't get near it."
"This way, you've got carte blanche."
"Within limits, of course."
"Does Dolan know I'm interested?" Lieutenant Dolan was an assistant division commander and an old antagonist of mine. He hated private investigators getting involved in police business.
"The case is Feldman's. He won't give a shit. You want me to talk to him?"
"Yeah, do that," I said. "And clear it with Dolan while you're at it. I'm tired of getting my hand smacked."
"Okay. I'll get back to you first thing Monday, then," Jonah said. "In the meantime, let me know if anything turns up."
"Right. Thanks."
I put a call through to Barbara Daggett, repeating the information I just received. When I finished, she was silent.
"What do you think?" she asked finally.
"Let's put it this way. I'm not satisfied, but it's your money. If you like, I can nose around for a couple of days, and if nothing turns up, we'll dump the whole business and you'll just have to live with it."
"What are the odds?"
"I have no idea. All I know to do is pick up a thread and see where it leads. We may come up with 6 dead ends, but at least you'll know we gave it a shot."
"Let's do it."
"Great. I'll be in touch."
I pushed the quilt aside and got up. I hoped Billy Polo was still around. I didn't know where else to start.
I unplugged the coffee pot, poured the balance of the coffee into a thermos, and then made myself a peanut butter and dill pickle sandwich, which I put in a brown paper bag like a school kid. I had just about the same feeling in my gut, too. The dull dread I'd experienced when I was 8, trudging off to Woodrow Wilson Elementary. I didn't want to go out in the rain.
I didn't want to connect up with Billy Polo, who was probably a creep. He sounded like one of the sixth-grade boys I'd been so fearful of. Lawless, out of control, and mean. I searched through my closet until I found my slicker and an umbrella. I left my warm apartment behind and drove over to Billy Polo's old address on Merced. It was 4:15 and getting prematurely dark. The neighborhood had probably been charming once, but it was gradually being overtaken by apartment buildings and was now no more than a hapless mix of the down at the heel and the bland. The little gingerbread structures were wedged between three-story stucco boxes with tenant parking underneath, and everywhere there was evidence of the same tasteless disregard for history. I parked under a pepper tree, using the overhanging branches as brief shelter while I put up my umbrella. I checked the names and house numbers of the two former neighbors, hoping one of them could give me a lead on Polo's current whereabouts. The first door I knocked on was answered by an elderly woman in a wheelchair, her legs wrapped in ace bandages and stuffed into lace-up shoes with slices cut out of the sides to accommodate her bunions. I stood on her leaky front porch, talking to her through the screen door, which she kept latched. She had a vague recollection of Billy, but had no idea what had happened to him or where he'd gone. She did direct me to a little rental unit at the rear of the property next door. This was not one of the addresses I'd picked up from the city directory. She said Billy's family had lived in the front house, while the rear was still occupied by an old gent named Talbot, who had been there for the last 30 years. I thanked her and picked my way down the rain-slicked stairs and back along the driveway. The front unit must have been one of the early houses in the area. A story and a half of white frame with a peaked roof, two dormers, and a front porch that was screened in now and furnished with junk. I could see the coils on the back side of an old refrigerator, and beside it what looked like a pillar of milk cartons filled with paperback books. Hydrangeas and bougainvillea grew together in a tangle along the side of the house, and the runoff from the rain gutter threw a gush of water out on the drive, forcing me to cut wide to the right. The rear unit looked like it was originally a tool shed with a lean-to attached to the left side and a tiny carport on the right. There was no car visible, and most of the sheltered space was taken up by a cord of firewood stacked against the wall. There was room left for a bicycle, maybe, but not much else. The structure was white frame, propped up on cinder blocks, with a window on either side of a central door and a tiny chimney poking up through the roof. It looked like the drawing we all did in grade school, even to the smoke curling up from the chimney pipe. I knocked, and the door was opened by a wizened old man with no teeth. His mouth was a wide line barely separating the tip of his nose from the upward thrust of his chin. When he caught sight of me and realized that I was no one he knew, he left the doorway briefly and returned with his dentures, smiling slightly as he shifted them into place. His false teeth made a crunching sound like a horse chewing on a bit. He looked to be in his 70s, frail, his pale skin speckled with red and blue, his white hair was brushed into a pompadour in front, shaggy over his ears and touching his collar in the back. He wore a shirt that looked soft from years of washing, and a cardigan sweater that probably belonged to a woman at some point. The buttons were rhinestone, and the buttonholes were on the wrong side. He smoothed his hair back with a trembling hand and waited to see what I could possibly want. "Are you Mr. Talbot?"
"Depends on who's asking," he said.
"I'm Kinsey Milhone. The woman next door suggested that I talk to you. I'm looking for Billy Polo. His family lived in that front house about 5 years ago."
"I know Billy quite well. Why are you looking for him?"
"I need some information about a friend of his," I said, and then gave him a brief explanation. I couldn't see any reason to prevaricate, so I simply stated my purpose and left it at that. He blinked at me.
"Billy Polo's a very bad fella. I wonder if you're aware of that."
His voice was powdery, and I noticed that he had a tremor, his head oscillating as he spoke. I guessed that he suffered from some form of Parkinsonism. "Yeah, I am. I heard he was up at the California Men's Colony until recently. I think that's where he met the man I'm referring to. Do you have any idea how I might reach him?"
"Well, you know, his mother is the one who owned that place," he said, nodding toward the front house. "She sold it about 2 years ago when she remarried."
"Is she still here in town?"
"Yes. And I believe she's living on Tranvia. Her married name is Christopher. Just a minute, and I'll give you the address."
He shuffled away, and a few moments later was back with a small address book in hand.
"She's a lovely woman. Sends me a card every year at Christmas time. Yes, here it is. Bertha Christopher. Goes by the nickname of Betty. If you chance to see her, I wish you'd give her my best.
I'll do that, Mr. Talbot. Thanks so much. Tranvia turned out to be a wide, treeless street off Milagro on the east side of town, a neighborhood of one-story frame houses on small lots, with chicken wire fences, unruly head-high